Hi, Ann Arbor AFers. This is co-host Jess Letaw with One More Thing. We've been talking at you for months. Now, we'd like to hear from you. What do you like about the pod? What do you wish we were doing more of or better? What ideas do you have for future episodes? We've put up a survey for you to fill out. There's a link to it in the show notes, or go to annarborAF.com/survey. That's annarborAF.com/survey. Send us your thoughts, questions, feels, and feedback on the pod so far. We want to hear it all. And as always, get informed, then get involved. It's your city.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Ann Arbor AF, a podcast for folks trying to figure out what's going on in Ann Arbor. We discuss current events in local politics and policy, governance, and other civic good times. I'm Molly Kleinman, and my pronouns are she, her.
I'm Michelle Hughes, and my pronouns are she, her.
And I'm Jess Letaw, and my pronouns are she, her.
We are your co-hosts to help you get informed and get involved. It's your city. Let's jump in.
Today, we're talking about the next city council meeting coming up Monday, May 3rd. We'll be touching on a few interesting agenda items, including shenanigans, the budget, and healthy streets, and offer some ways for you to get involved. A quick process note, we record this a few days before the council meeting, which means there will likely be some changes to the agenda between now and then.
Today, we're actually only recording it one day before the council meeting.
That's right. So there will still be changes, though. There is always like horses traded on the Mondays. Yes.
Oh, and we're going to talk about that. Get yes. to the council rules.
That's right. But between now and then, first thing on the agenda is me.
Yay.
I'm in the mayor's communication number two. I mention occasionally I am on the board of the Downtown Development Authority, the DDA, and my term is up for reappointment. And I haven't set anything on fire or licked a stranger recently, so I'm being reappointed. That is a thing that happened in Florida, by the way. City council what? Member licked a stranger and got bounced. So, like, that's my bar for good behavior. Wow. Have I licked someone? No, I'm doing fine.
Right. I'd rather have council members lick people than do what they've been doing.
Isn't that a terrible conversation, though? Like, speaking of shenanigans.
Yeah.
So, Molly, you have some thoughts on Healthy Streets.
Yes, Healthy Streets is on the consent agenda. It's CA-14. And this is the proposal to actually make Healthy Streets happen. We've been talking about it periodically over the last few months. There was an allocation to do planning for Healthy Streets. That planning has happened. There is now a plan. And now this is asking for budget approval to actually implement Healthy Streets. And because it's an off-cycle budget allocation, it council has to approve it, and it actually needs to get 8 votes. So I will say here that I'm a little worried about Healthy Streets this year. The plans look amazing, and I think they've done a really excellent job of addressing the feedback and complaints that they got from last year. But it's a high price tag this year, partly because some of the changes that they are proposing to make would be permanent changes, and some of them involve road resurfacing. And so the costs are pretty high. It's a total of over $350,000. And so I'm a little worried. However, all that money comes from the Act 51 gas tax money. So like from street, what that means is it's coming from streets funds, where the only thing we could spend this money on is streets. It's not coming from the general fund at all. But you know, some of the opposition to Healthy Streets has been loud, and some of those complaints have had a sympathetic ear among members of council, and so I'm a little worried about it. But I want to like talk for a minute about the various ways that they've addressed problems from last year, because we talked about how Healthy Streets last year, it happened very quickly, it wasn't perfect, there were a bunch of problems. So some of the changes this year, they're looking at implementations that are using what we call paint and post. So they're actually painting new lines on the streets. They're using vertical delineators that will get glued onto the road. No more construction barrels. The look that we had last year, where on some of those major streets, like on South Packard, where it looked like construction and no one was really sure where to go, that's not happening this year. And especially on that stretch of South Packard, what they're going to do because they had previously taken away a lane on each side. And instead they're keeping all the travel lanes, but they're narrowing them, and they're able to narrow the lanes to the extent that you can actually fit bike lanes onto that stretch of Packard. So this is Packard from Eisenhower all the way to like almost Carpenter, I think. So basically all the way to the city limit, a stretch of Packard that is a really important bike corridor that does not currently have bike facilities, where a lot of people are biking. It leads to parts of the community where the car ownership is lower. So there's lots of really good reasons to improve biking through that stretch. And so this would be a permanent change. And again, that's part of why these are going to be more expensive. So that's Packard. The neighborhood streets, they're going to have better signage for the neighborhood streets, so that for some of the streets that are quite long, there was an issue where like there was a sign at one end and a sign at the other end, and then no signs in between. So any streets that intersected, there was nothing to indicate that they should slow down, yes, or watch out. And now there will be signage at the feeder streets in addition.
I like that a lot.
It's great. They really listened. Like they really, really listened to the feedback. I can't think of any complaints that have not been addressed in some way, except for the people who just don't want them at all. And, you know, those people are not ever going to be happy.
Well, and part of it was based on the survey data after the projects last year, we got a really good sense that people who used the projects on bike or on foot were overwhelmingly in favor. And people who didn't use the projects, or B, only use them in a car, were in general less in favor. And that speaks, I think, to what we're trying to prioritize, right? We're trying to prioritize health and comfort outside of cars. So that privilege rebalancing is going to feel different. So I think it's important to know where the disagreement is coming from.
Yeah, I think that's right. Another thing to notice about the deployments this year, some of the popular streets from last year are not on this list, and that's because they're being taken over by the DDA. So it's not that they're not happening this year, but for one of the most popular routes was on Division, which is one way northbound. And there was a temporary two-way bike lane installed on Division. And that was incredibly popular. And the DDA has said, we want this bike lane back and we want it permanent. So the DDA is actually going to be installing a permanent two-way bikeway on Division later this summer.
That's right.
So the reason it's not on this list is not because it's not happening. It's because it's happening in a different way and happening for good.
That's great. Are there any other ones like that?
That is the main one this year.
Well, that's a friggin' good one.
Yeah. And then also the downtown street closures, like around the restaurants and things, which last year were included under the Healthy Streets umbrella, this year are outside of the Healthy Streets umbrella. So this year, Healthy Streets is really the neighborhood slow streets and just three major street reconfigurations. It's South Main and the two chunks of Packard. And the other chunk of Packard is downtown at Hill. And there used to be a bike lane there, but then during construction, it got taken away and they just never put it back. And so this is restoring a bike lane we used to have. But the issue with that chunk, and this is something I pointed out because it used to be part of my commute, the place where the bike lane would be on that stretch of Packard is basically one big pothole. And that section of road isn't scheduled to be fully resurfaced for another like 4 or 5 years. And so one of the high ticket, like big ticket items in this budget is to resurface just the bike lane section of Packard, which is a thing they did last year for a couple of the deployments. And so this is,
interesting.
It's not like super like out of the ordinary for a kind of thing we might do, but it would resurface those sections because otherwise you would have people in the bike lane with delineators sort of keeping them in the bike lane in a place where I usually leave the bike lane because it's so, the
pavos are so rough over there. Yeah.
Right.
So it would
require. What did you say? Delineators? I like delineators.
Yeah. Delineators. These are the, like, we don't have a lot of them yet. I'm hopeful that we will get many more. Mm-hmm. It's the, they're sort of thin plastic vertical sticks that get glued to the street, basically.
Yeah, that's great. I was worried that some of these things are just going to, we're just going to be paint and pray bike lanes, but these are South, these all going to be delineated?
South Main is going to have delineators for sure. South Packard, I don't remember. There was some back and forth about it. I think it's mostly going to be just paint on South Packard. But the thing with South Packard is that whole corridor really needs a reimagining, you know, on the scale of like the reimagined Washtenaw. And this is sort of like step one. There need to be substantial changes to that whole corridor that we're not quite prepared to make yet. But this would be a really great start, and it would address a really important corridor again for specifically bikes. Oh, and I forgot to mention a very important piece of this. On South Packard, they're going to narrow the lanes, which means they can lower the speed limit. Mm. And the narrower lanes will help slow down traffic, but then also they can actually lower the posted speed limit, which will help make it safer for everyone moving through that corridor.
I like it.
Yeah, I do too. There's so much to love here, but I also understand how there could be some sticker shock with the total price.
Yeah, and well, then the thing is, like, you know, because that money can only be spent on road things. It's like all we would be foregoing is some road resurfacing. And I know that that's the top priority of some people is for the roads to be resurfaced underneath their cars. But like, I've also heard a rumor that like we spend so much on road resurfacing that like it's not even possible to spend more because like there just aren't the people to do the work. The asphalt doesn't exist. Like, you know, I saw that. I think that was like a couple of years ago. They added like $5 million from from one of the reserve funds to do extra road resurfacing, and they just couldn't spend it because we were already spending the maximum amount that could be spent.
That doesn't surprise me. I haven't heard that, but given there was a long period in the aughts where resurfacing wasn't happening, and we sort of fell into debt on our road maintenance. And this is true statewide, but I think especially in Ann Arbor. And so that really wouldn't surprise me.
I think part of the problem is that just we've built for such low densities that you need a lot of road per person. And of course, that's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
Molly, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
One of the things that I appreciate about how this is being presented. So you're talking about sticker shock. We're looking at a cost of around $350,000 for this year's Healthy Streets projects outside of the downtown. But that a third of that is going into road resurfacing. This is consistent a little bit with how the DDA talks about its road project costs. One of the things that we've come to understand is that, like you say, the sticker shock is there, the cost seems high, but through analyzing the last several years of projects, we've come to understand that infrastructure updates constitute around 70% of our project costs. And so we know streetlights will be improved, we know water mains will be upsized, we know sidewalks will be improved, and that helps kind of make these large project costs feel more palatable in a way that then results in safer streets for people outside of cars. And so all I'm saying is I see some consistency in how this is being talked about in a way that for me gives it more information and more, I don't know, more friendliness, more budget friendliness.
Nice. That's great. And I don't know that it's two thirds are all just resurfacing, but there's like the painting, it's the implementations that are going to be permanent. And then the third one, along South Main, is a real classic road diet. So it's going from two lanes in either direction to one car lane in either direction, a middle turn lane, and bike lanes. And the bike lanes will be buffered and or have some vertical.
Yes, please.
Yeah, and that stretch of South Main has been a huge problem for many years, going way before the Healthy Streets. And the deployment on South Main last year had some serious problems that I think this new version really fixes, but to do it this way is more expensive because you have to repaint all the lines on the road. But I used to live down there and I stopped biking places when I lived on the other side of Maine in that part of town, because it was just like so unfriendly. There's a really terrifying crossing, like on the top of a hill, there's this crosswalk, it's right by the stadium. There's just a lot down there that would be really improved for everyone, especially pedestrians, by getting rid of a lane of car traffic in either direction. So
I like it.
Anyway, this is all wonderful. I love it. And I hope that it just stays in the consent agenda and passes, but I wanted to give some details to folks in case it gets pulled and gets talked about. And in case you, like me, like the Healthy Streets and might want to let your council members know that you're in favor of this plan.
That was my question to you is, do you have a specific call to action?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like write your council members, call in. I think there's going to be a lot of folks trying to call in tomorrow for a few different things. So, you know, just a quick email saying, I really love the Healthy Streets. I want to see them come back. I'm really excited about them. Just a nice positive email. I don't know that council, how many of those council gets.
And definitely do let them know, because this is an 8-vote thing and we don't know who's going to be that 8th vote. We gotta make someone be the 8th vote.
So I'm going to stop talking about Healthy Streets now. It looks like we're moving on to Jess and the 1 million public hearings.
That's right. There are 10, but it's a lot more than we usually have. So I have a couple of public hearing items that are interesting to me. The first one seemed super interesting. It was a site plan review and approval for 614 South Ashley. I opened it up with great appetite. Nope. It's a 289 square foot second floor addition on a piece of on an office, basically. I'm not sure why it's coming to council. I mean, I'm sure that there was some like specific element of the project that triggered council review, but this is not something that rises to the level of policy attention. So whatever we have in our process that allows this one to come to council for vote, just I think that that needs a little bit of looking at. What I'd like to spend a little more time on is the budget, public hearing 10. So it's the public hearing now with the vote per our city council charter, the second meeting in May, which is May 17th. That vote will come with amendments that we don't currently know. Council members and the city administrator are going to be busy making last minute adjustments to individual line items and service areas in the budget. So that now is a good time to pay attention and be asking questions. A couple of line items that I'll call out. Actually, before I get into the line items, I want to note, we did our deeper dive on the budget 3 or 4 months ago now. And ever since then, I have watched more working sessions on the budget and paid closer attention than I ever have, just because I wanted to be able to talk about it cogently on the pod, really. Like, this is just kind of homework for me. Knowing everything that I know, opening up this week's agenda and looking at this particular resolution on the budget, it is very hard to read this for legible information, even having paid attention. So I'm just kind of affirming for those of you who are like, I don't understand the budget. Solidarity, man. I'm right there with you. So a couple of line items that are interesting on this that do not show up in the budget, but we will drop a link to in the show notes to the budget presentation that the city did back in February. There have been line item updates since then that do show up in this resolution. So there's not a presentation that describes the resolution. There's not a resolution that describes a presentation, but it gives you a little bit more context. And I'd also encourage you to go back and listen to the episode that we did on the budget, because we did get pretty deep into different service areas then. What we know is that there will be an allocation for the new unarmed responder program, if it's what it was before. And again, can't tell from this resolution, but if it's what it was before, it'll be $276,000. Which doesn't hold a candle to the $31 million bucket that the police currently have. We're also looking at this coming fiscal year of spending a lot more money on sidewalks and affordable housing, thanks to the millages that passed last year. We're also going to be seeing substantial increases in the Office of Sustainability and Innovation, which is where our carbon neutrality plan A20 comes out of. Again, super hard to read the resolution for that, but we do have some really cool work coming forward this year. There's also a couple of public hearings on specific areas of fees. Nothing that's earth-shaking. It's just bringing fees charged by the different service areas of the city in line with the budget changes that are being made. Thoughts and questions from my fellow co-hosts?
I'm just like, I feel like I need to call into the public hearing, talk about something, because this is the budget and this is what's going to be the main thing. I'm definitely going to be talking about, we need to be spending more on the unarmed responders and less on the police. Because it seems like such a paltry amount to spend on them, but I guess they're thinking, we don't know what we're doing yet. So they didn't want to commit a whole bunch of money without knowing what they were committing it to, but dang, I don't know.
Right. I don't even know where that money is going to get spent under yet.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And one thing I hope about that is that I want to make sure that any unarmed responders that we do have are not like part of the police department. Like I want that to be a whole separate kind of thing. And then another thing I would say about unarmed responders is that a lot of people like to conflate it with mental health, and they say like, oh, these should be mental health responders. And then they're like, oh, why shouldn't we just have the county do this? Cause they already have community mental health. But I think there's a lot of things that the police respond to that aren't violent crimes and also aren't mental health crises. There's a lot of just like, someone is yelling about something. What's their deal? Like, there's a lot of, you know, just like people mad at their neighbor about this and that. That's, you know, the police told me that at one of their public meetings, they were like, the vast majority of their calls are just neighborhood disputes. And
we do have a community arbitration center. I don't know very much at all about how that works, but it's possible that diverting more funding to them would be productive.
Is that some kind of a nonprofit group or something?
It is a part of the government. I don't know if it's like Avalon Housing where they subcontract out to a nonprofit. That's something that I'm happy for us to look more into later.
I have never heard of that.
So that's a thing. Yeah. So if you, like Michelle, have questions about anything budget related, now is a great time to talk to your city council member and just ask them, what do they care about? What are they working on? Ask about the things you care about, like healthy streets or sidewalks or various fun things, the art commission perhaps, and how those things are being budgeted for. Now is really when that picture is starting to emerge. So drop an email to your city council member and just ask some friendly questions about the budget. Speaking of dollar things, Michelle, you have some things to say about fees.
Okay. So we have a really interesting ordinance coming up for first reading here. It's the third party delivery fee ordinance, and it is a regulation of the market in a way that I didn't know that our city had the power to do it. and I think it's a really interesting application of it. So, you know, restaurants around here have been in a bind because of COVID, because people can't come and eat at the restaurant. And so a lot of our beloved local institutions have gone under, and some of them are struggling. But a lot of them have survived only by having the ability to deliver food, which they've never had to do before. And so a lot of them are turning to these third-party delivery services, things like DoorDash, Uber Eats, Grubhub, Eat Street. So that does allow the restaurants to sell food to people that they wouldn't otherwise be able to, but they are apparently charging the restaurants extortionate rates, sometimes in excess of 30% of the fee. And the restaurants feel like they're in a bind because they, you know, it's either they pay the extortionate fees or they just can't sell anything to anyone.
While we are excited about this resolution coming, and Michelle will say more about it in a moment, I just want to acknowledge that the heavy breathing is not our excitement. It's that we are being joined by Juliet the Greyhound. So she also is excited about reducing restaurant fees. All right, go ahead, Michelle.
All right. So this resolution would limit the fee to 15%. So DoorDash or whatever can't charge restaurants more than 15% of the cost of the food. Another funny thing about it is that it's a temporary ordinance that would go away after the COVID regulations are over. So once people can eat indoors again, then DoorDash can go back to charging whatever it wants.
There's another piece of this too, right? About the inaccurate menus, which
yes,
a thing I get frustrated by as a consumer when it's hard to find a correct menu for a restaurant. And so Frequently, these services will have an out-of-date menu or an incorrect menu, but then people get mad at the restaurant for not having what they want. And so this ordinance also requires these third-party deliverers to make sure their menus are correct.
Right. And it's kind of funny because like it makes it like a violation of the ordinance to charge more fees, but also to have an inaccurate menu. And so it would charge these delivery companies $500 a day for every day they have an inaccurate menu. And that sounds kind of wild. Like, it sounds difficult to enforce. I don't know. It'll be real interesting to see this happen. One thing that worries me a little bit about it is that it has a clause. There's a clause in there. It's number 2C, I believe. And so it's, you know, we're talking about they can't charge more than 15%. But if the company signs a specific contract with the restaurant where the contract agrees to let the company charge more than 15%, as long as the delivery company is including other services such as advertising, then it's totally kosher. So I don't see any reason why these companies wouldn't just like bust in there and be like, well, it sure would be bad if you didn't get listed on our app anymore. Better sign this contract, you know.
That makes me wonder. And the first time that I saw this resolution was this morning when we were previewing the agenda. So I don't know anything more about it than, you know, what we've got at the table right now. This makes me wonder how toothless the resolution is, because right. It's my understanding that a lot of those third party delivery services, it's delivery is just one part of what the contract covers. Mm-hmm. The reason that they justify the higher fees, and again, this is my understanding talking to restaurant friends, is because of those other services that they're providing. We're listing you on our website. Right. We're marketing you through our newsletters. So I'm just wondering, like, are we posturing on this, or is this a real thing? I don't know the answer. I am excited to see this because there has been gouging. So if there's a mechanism to change it, I'm glad that we're taking that on. I just wonder.
Because I'm just real worried that what's going to happen is everyone's going to just sign the contract and this thing means nothing. Because it's tough when these delivery companies have such market penetration right now. I've seen the way people use them. They go first to the delivery app, you know, and then they'll start punching stuff into the delivery app. And I'm like, did you know that they also have their own in-house delivery? Why don't you just order off of their website? You know, but people just go first to the delivery app. And so I think some restaurants might feel like they have to keep paying these extortionate rates because of the service of being listed on the app. Because if people are only going to buy things that they see listed on the app, like, I don't know, like I'm real worried about that. You can sign a contract and nullify this ordinance thing.
And this is really, we're going to be talking a few times today about council taking positions on issues that seem beyond council purview. This is really the first one. And this actually transitions a little bit into the next thing, Michelle, that you had wanted to talk about. Okay, if we get into that one?
Sure. Yeah, let's go into that one. Oh boy. Resolution to improve.
Welcome to the shenanigans part.
Yes. The shenanigans and the shenanigans correspondent. Resolution to improve council effectiveness, performance, and communication. So, round about April 11th, Councilmember Jeff Hayner took to Facebook to complain about journalists, which he hates. And in doing so, he used a homophobic slur. He used the F slur. And this angered a lot of my LGBTQ friends, because it puts us in danger. Because, you know, we have a society in which it is difficult to be an LGBT person. We face discrimination. We face harassment. We face all kinds of problems. We face people, you know, families shun their LGBT members. People get kicked out of their homes. We face housing insecurity. And so here a council member comes to throw some more insults at us, and encourage those people who are already hurting us. So at the last council meeting, the city council responded to that by passing a resolution to remove Jeff Hayner from his committee assignments, which is something that they have the power to do from the city charter, because the city charter says that, you know, committee assignments are made at the behest of council, and any council member can be removed from a committee for cause. It was a brutal 1.5 hour discussion at the last council meeting. And a lot of things were discussed, and the things that were mainly not discussed were the safety of the LGBTQ community. It was mostly council members who didn't want to see this happen, who are supportive of Jeff Hayner being able to do whatever he wants and hurt the LGBTQ community, saying, "How dare you do this to our beloved Jeff Hayner?" And questioning council's authority to do it, even though the city attorney had said in no uncertain terms that council has the authority to do this. So it was the resolution to remove him from committees was passed 8-2, with Jeff Hayner being
abstaining or recusing.
Recusing. So Nelson and Ramlawi voted not to remove him from committees. Ramlawi and Griswold voted not to remove him from committees. Nelson spoke a lot about that this shouldn't be something that the city council can do, but then ended up voting to do it. But it was not the healing that the LGBTQ community needed. If people were feeling unsafe approaching their council members, that discussion did not help them feel more safe and welcome in public participation. Now, Councilmember Griswold, who voted not to remove Hayner from committees, is bringing back this resolution, which was postponed on that night. And that is the resolution to improve council effectiveness, performance, and communication. And kind of the whole premise of this resolution is that the response to Hayner's homophobic remarks was disproportionate, and that it's part of factional arguments and not part of a genuine desire to help the LGBTQ community. The premise of this resolution is, if the council could just learn to get along, they would have seen that the reasonable thing to do is to let this slide. And it is my contention that it is not reasonable to let homophobia slide, and that that's how we get more homophobia. So this is a resolution that seeks to bridge the divide between the factions on the city council. If this had been proposed not in the context of protecting Jeff Hayner from consequences, then I might have a different feel about it. But it was proposed in that context, and it contains a resolve clause that says that any actions that have been taken against council members are now undone, and instead we're going to have a mediation process. So it still really reads as a Protect Jeff Hayner resolution, and a like slap in the face to the LGBTQ community who was hurt by Hayner's actions. It also allocates $20,000 from the budget to hire mediators to watch city council meetings and then meet with council members afterwards and tell them how they could have done better. And I don't know, it's It seems like a strange expense in a time when we didn't really talk about it when we talked about the budget, but we have a major budget deficit right now on the order of $3 million because of COVID. And so we're borrowing against some of our, reserve money just to keep basic city operations going. And here it's talking about, you know, allocating $20,000 to teach council how to get along. And
I don't think,
I'm not sure that was the problem in the first place, you know?
Yeah, I think this misidentifies both the problem and the solution is what I would say. No amount of mediation is going to work when both parties are not when at least one party is not operating in good faith. And right. I think that's what we're dealing with here.
So Michelle, I'm curious if you have a call to action around this resolution.
I really don't know how to respond. I guess continue calling your city council representatives and emailing them and telling them that the problem was the LGBT discrimination. And the problem is not council effectiveness on the, you know, on their factions. Like, if they could remove the thing that would undo the action that they take against Jeff Hayner, then we could consider this separately. Like, and that was something that Griswold said that she would be interested in doing last time, but when they postponed this at the last meeting, it came back in its original form. So I don't know if she still intends to do that, but she very much better intend to do that. But still, I think it just feels really wrong to ignore the harm to the LGBTQ community and focus so much on the harm to a Jeff Hayner. Because I don't know, there's some people out there who love Jeff Hayner, and they're saying that they feel that their representation is being stripped away by having him removed from committees. But like, my representation is being stripped away by having him on committees, because I'm not going to talk to a homophobic bigot. And I don't think that it's right to require LGBT people in our community to talk to a bigot if they want to get things done on these committees. So another thing about it is that it the $20,000 that it allocates from the budget, it's $20,000 because that's an amount that won't require 8 votes from the to pass as a budget resolution. But Kathy Griswold says she's sure she's found someone who's willing to do it for free. I'm sure that'll be great. It kind of weirds me out that she can just like find someone who thinks they can do it, and it doesn't have to go through like an RFP process that we're going to, like, you know, the city administrator is going to find the best mediator available for the money. Like, it's weird that Kathy Griswold would just be able to like make some phone calls and assign this to and assign this mediation job to someone. So it,
right.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, mm-hmm. then make that what it is. Make it something that you all, and I guess I'm talking directly to council here. If this mm-hmm. is something that you feel like you need, I'm not sure that you need public monies or right. public observation to be able to go through this process. You all are humans. Mm-hmm. who are working together on a really important job of representing the strategy and policy of a city that we all care about. To have something like this keep coming back because there's a failure to be able to do it on your own, Molly's description of this is wrong problem, wrong solution. Mm-hmm. This keeps sitting wrong because I just don't know that this needs to be a council table discussion. I feel like this needs to be happening with your ward co-representatives, with your colleagues. I think, in fact, the further away from an audience that this happens, the better. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what I have to say about that. I'm going to pass it over to Molly to talk about something else while I take a little break.
A breath. Yeah, so this next resolution that we're going to talk about is DC-3, which is a resolution to request MDOT address frequency of commercial truck crashes on M-14 bridge over the Huron River. This has been a known problem spot on M-14 for many years. And what precipitated this particular resolution is that there was one day in April where there were 3 truck crashes over the course of like a 24-hour period, 3 serious commercial truck crashes. One of them caused a diesel spill into the river. The other 2 both involved a rollover of the truck and the trailer. In a previous year, a truck driver was killed in a crash at this spot. It's very unsafe, and there is a long and sordid history of MDOT not caring what municipalities want or need when it comes to safety for the roads and streets that MDOT controls that you know come into cities or are near cities. And so this is an issue where MDOT has said no repeatedly. They're not going to do anything to fix this location. Now we've had 3 more, oh, it was a 48-hour period, excuse me, 3 more crashes in a 48-hour period. And the city, I think, is using this as another opportunity to push for changes. And I don't expect this to be a controversial resolution. I care more about the whole MDOT dynamic, which has been a problem for us in places throughout the city. The reason Washtenaw kind of sucks is because MDOT hasn't let us do anything to make it better. It can take years to get approval for a single traffic light, situations like that. So that's what's happening here. There's a really bad spot. There were a lot of crashes. The city is trying again to get MDOT to do something about it. And hopefully maybe this time MDOT will listen. I see in the resolution that they are sending it to the local state legislative delegation and to the governor. Maybe since there's been some change of control of the state over the last couple of years, maybe there will be some new appetite for addressing this particular spot.
And I will say this is a shout. In policy terms, this is a shout. Typically, work with MDOT is addressed through staff channels. So transportation staff, DDA staff, whoever would talk to the relevant departments and service units within MDOT. On rare occasions, I know the assistant city administrator and city administrator have gotten involved with higher level staff at MDOT. For a policymaker to say something like this, like they are really trying to get attention and really trying to make a change. So I just want to kind of note that.
Yeah, that's helpful. So that's all I had to say about that. And now I feel like we're ping ponging today between transportation and shenanigans and transportation and shenanigans. Now we are back to shenanigans with DC-5 and the council rules.
This one really doesn't have to be shenanigans. These look like they're all a bunch of, these are mostly a bunch of reasonable proposals to deal with, you know, some reasonable changes to council rules. So council rules are the rules about how the council governs itself.
And there have been some shenanigans about the council rules.
There have been, yes. Well, so there's some of the stuff. Okay, some of the stuff addresses shenanigans. I'll say that much. And some of the stuff is indeed a continuance of some shenanigans. But there's a couple things in here that I really like. Okay, so saying that most of this is good was probably an exaggeration. So one of them that seems like a perfectly reasonable and good suggestion to me is that anything added to the city council agenda after 5 p.m. Thursday has to have 3 sponsors on council, or at the council meeting, they have to take a majority vote in order to put anything on the agenda. And that seems reasonable because we deal with, you know, that when they put the council agenda in front of the public, and then We have a chance to react to it. We have a chance to talk to our council members about it. We have a chance to make podcasts about it. And so when things come in too late for us to talk about and address as a public, that does, you know, hurt our ability to, you know, have a wide-ranging conversation. So I think this is reasonable. It doesn't totally forbid things from being added, but it says that it's got to be a big deal in order to do it. So that's that I like. Let's see. Oh, but one thing is one thing this would do is that, like, to add things to the agenda at the meeting. So like if you're at the meeting, nothing has ever been on the website, no member of the public has ever seen this thing. That's the worst time to add something to an agenda, I think. And previously that required a 3/4 vote to put things onto the agenda in that way. But this reduces it to a 1/2 vote, to just a simple majority. So I'm not sure I like that. I like the idea of, like, you know, requiring things that come in late to go on there, but something that's never been on the website at all, I feel like that should probably still have a 3/4 vote. Like, I remember there was a resolution a few years ago trying to pass an ordinance about cracking down on protesters against the deer cull. And it seemed like a pretty big deal to, like, put new police measures in place, to new laws that people could be, you know, new things that people could be arrested for in place on, you know, to put that on the agenda at the last minute where no one can see it. That was, you know, so I would like for that sort of thing to require a 3/4 vote. But anyway, that's one of the things that's on there. Mostly good. Another thing that I like is, if a council member wants to badmouth the staff, talk to the administrator, not to the public.
Is something that we've heard a lot over the last several years, is council complaining about specific staff, about departments, about staff in general. It sets up a pretty toxic working dynamic between council and staff. It also, I think, creates a more problematic relationship between staff and the general public, because now people who are listening, kind of like you were talking about with homophobic language, not nearly to that extent, but council constituents listening to their council members talk about staff in really disrespectful ways breeds distrust by the general community and staff. I mean, I'm not saying give them a blank check and let them do anything, but I'm saying come to it with a working relationship. And so asking council members to bring concerns about staff to their manager, namely the city administrator, to me, that's a big win.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I feel like trust in the government, faith in the government, it's a really fragile thing. It's something that we need to, work really hard to foster. It's something that the city council shouldn't be getting up there and telling people not to have faith in their government, because, like, you know, we literally had people attempt to overthrow the government a couple months ago, people, like, you know. And so when council members get up there and they badmouth the staff, that feeds into this whole idea that, oh, the government is bad, we shouldn't even bother, why should I get involved? And it tends to be like things where council members want the staff to do a thing, but they haven't actually brought forward a resolution to change the way staff does things, or they have opinions that are beyond their expertise. You know, the council members have opinions that are beyond their expertise and don't understand why staff is choosing to do things that way. And so they take it to the public. And it seems like a bad plan. So another thing on there is So another thing on there that I want to talk about is a brand new council rule, Rule 13, council behavioral norms. And this is all aspirational language. There's nothing like that council members can be punished for, but it is things like, you know, work effectively with other council members, encourage free expression of opinion on policy issues by all council members. Like use the same care and caution on social media. Avoid derogatory or denigrating language, Councilmember Hayner. But then another thing is a thing from some code of ethics that's for city administrators, not for council members, but they pulled a few things that they liked. Affirm the dignity and worth of local government services and maintain a deep sense of social responsibility as a trusted public servant. I like that. And things like that. So that's, you know, an aspirational council ethics rule 13, council behavior norms. It's hard to argue with because it's just, hey, can't we be nice and do good? Yes, yes, we can. At least I hope we can. We just have to try. But then the other thing is the much hated redress of grievances, rule 10. In rule 10, it was a thing that said that if a council member has had their motives impugned and their and things like that, then they can take it to council administration committee. And council member Ramlawi threatened to sue the city if he was ever brought up under these rules. And he got the ACLU to even write a letter saying that this would chill his speech.
Not actually the ACLU though, right? Like,
no, it was a local ACLU lawyers unit. And it was reviewed. They wrote a letter and it was reviewed by the staff, by the ACLU staff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was weird. So yeah, this change takes that rule out of rule 10 and puts it in rule 12, therefore satisfying everyone. It puts it in there in less specific language, but rule 12 is council ethics rules. And it adds that council members can be counseling and reprimand. And that's something that can happen now with any conduct that is unbecoming of a council member. So it's something that when Jeff Hayner was being discussed, when removing him from committees was being discussed, a lot of the council members who were supporting him were really confused because there was nothing in the council ethics rule 12 preventing someone from using homophobic slurs to attack the LGBTQ community. So they're like, you can't harm him. You know, you can't take him off of council committees because there's nothing in the rules. Well, this would put that in the rules under conduct unbecoming a council member. But I also don't like that phrasing because it's so vague.
There's definitely a concern that something like this would be kind of weaponized politically, right? So I disagree with you, therefore I'm going to punish you. Right. And I think that there's room to find a way of making that censure possible without kind of arming it on the political side. I do not know what the answer is here, but I don't think the answer is to not do it.
Right. But yeah, I'm a little concerned about the phrasing of conduct unbecoming a council member, because that sounds, it reminds me of the Red Scare. Like right now, that's not what I would be worried about. But like, I'm concerned that if norms change a little bit, I would prefer the more specific language that we had before saying what can be reprimanded. But another thing is that like, moving these concerns into council rule 12 doesn't take away the council's ability to remove Jeff Hayner from committees, it adds another thing that the council could do, which is have the administration committee write a letter about it. So I don't know. It's a real interesting discussion. Keep an eye on it. Talk to council members about it. Read the rules. Fun times. What's next?
DC2, resolution in support of Michigan Senate Bill 352 with Jess.
And I'm not sure that I would have brought this up, except the context is interesting. So earlier we talked about the resolution to request that MDOT address the frequency of crashes on a particular stretch of M14. In a moment, we're going to talk about a council resolution addressing policy far beyond Ann Arbor city borders. This one is in support of, as Molly said, Michigan Senate Bill 352, which is a bill around local gun control. And I just think it's interesting the different ways that city council can take positions on or make statements about actions that are happening beyond the city. I don't think I realized how often they did it until I saw three very different ones show up in the same meeting. This one is pretty straightforward. I don't know that there's going to be a lot of discussion or any disagreement about it, possibly. It takes no stance on what the gun control is. This particular bill is about moving the power of certain enforcement from the state level to the municipal level. So I just wanted to call that out, that the city has a number of different ways of speaking to issues beyond its borders. And this one, I mean, it feels appropriate. It has to do with municipal control. And so the city taking a stance on it feels relevant. Not quite the same as DC6.
All right, DC6. Resolution for city to hold a community conversation about the Palestinian people and Palestinian Americans. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this one. It felt like we had to at least mention it, but this is an unserious resolution. It's a distraction and it is not worth a lot of our time. So I have instead a very brief list of facts that I'm going to read. And that's all we're going to say about DC6 today. So first of all, there's only one sponsor for this resolution. It's Kathy Griswold. Councilmember Ramlawi, who is Palestinian American, is not a co-sponsor of this resolution. 2, Ann Arbor has a vibrant Palestinian American community. Members of that community have not asked for a resolution like this. 3, most of the whereases in this resolution are about opposition to Israel and not the lives of Palestinian Americans here in Ann Arbor. 4, there is a small group of people, none of whom are Palestinian or even Arab American, who protest every Saturday morning outside of one of Ann Arbor's synagogues during worship services and also frequently speak at city council meetings. They hold signs with swastikas, claim the Holocaust was a hoax, and use anti-Semitic language like talking about Jewish power. They regularly demand that city council pass a resolution condemning Israel. I think perhaps they also have asked for a resolution like this. And that is all we're going to say about this resolution.
If they're going to do a community conversation about something, why not homophobia?
Yeah, right. Yes, that would be a great thing to have a community conversation about at this particular moment in time. This one is out of left field and I'm not going to talk about it anymore. So we're going to move right along. This was the last resolution we had on our list for today. So we're going to move into the closing time of our thing. It sounds like we don't have any corrections this week.
Got it all right.
So I will thank all of you, our listeners, and those of you who have supported us on Ko-fi. If you'd like to send us a few dollars to cover our hosting fees, you can find us at ko-fi.com/AnnArborAF.
And that's it for this episode of Ann Arbor AF. We're your co-hosts, Molly Kleinman, Michelle Hughes, and myself, Jess Leetaw. And thanks to our producer, Jack Jennings, who's stepping in to pinch hit for Jared Malestein. For questions about this podcast or ideas about future episodes, you can email us at annarborafpod@gmail.com. Theme music, I Don't Know, by Grapes. Get informed, then get involved. It's your city. Hi, Ann Arbor AFers. This is co-host Jess Leetaw with one more thing. We've been talking at you for months. Now We'd like to hear from you. What do you like about the pod? What do you wish we were doing more of or better? What ideas do you have for future episodes? We've put up a survey for you to fill out. There's a link to it in the show notes, or go to AnnArborAF.com/survey. That's AnnArborAF.com/survey. Send us your thoughts, questions, feels, and feedback on the pod so far. We want to hear it all. And as always, get informed, then get involved. It's your city.